Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Yesterday, this might have come and gone without your notice, but yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, was the anniversary of Martin Luther's death. An interesting story in and of itself. Really, very interesting story. Odd coincidence. He dies in the same town where he was born. Just happened to be visiting. That's just part of the story. We're going to do a brief biography of Martin Luther with Dr. Cameron McKenzie for the next half hour of Issues Etc. If you got a question or a comment on Martin Luther, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio. We're coming to you live this Monday. It's the 19th of February. Issues ETC at KFUO.org. In 25 minutes, Dr. Arthur Brooks joins us. He's written this book called Who Really Cares? America's Charity Divide. Who gives, who doesn't, and why it matters. We'll talk about religion, philosophy, and charitable giving. His research for that book turned up some counter-to-expectation findings on who gives and who doesn't give. And then in the third hour of the program, we're going to review Beth Moore's teaching this week. Beth Moore is very popular in a lot of churches across denominational lines. She's a Bible teacher. A lot of churches are using her books, her tapes, and her program. She's in the middle of a series called Building New Walls from Forgiveness to Freedom, and we'll find out what she has to say about forgiveness. A bit of a sermon teaching review in the last hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. I'm pleased to be with you this afternoon.
Well, how do you walk over ground that there are books written about him? Someone once said that apart from maybe Jesus, Luther gets more pages devoted to him of history and of biography. How do you go over that ground of a person who people either know really well or confuse with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, you know, I think that probably most people are in the latter category rather than the first. But even with those people who've know a lot about Luther, there's probably always more to know, or maybe new questions to ask about him.
The way Luther is thought of today, and I might be wrong about this, but my read on how the average American thinks about Luther, who knows about Luther, and including many Lutherans, is he was a rebel. A good kind of rebel.
Mm-hmm.
He fought authority and he didn't take anything from anyone and he drew the line in the sand and he told authority where to get off the train. Is that an accurate reading of Luther as a man?
No, but I can see why people might have that impression because clearly, for reasons of conscience, convinced by the Word of God that the gospel had been lost and obscured, he was willing to defy ecclesiastical authority that was not preaching or teaching in accordance with that word. But as a general rule, Luther wasn't a strong advocate of let's call it the social and political hierarchy of his day, and did not think that a person should, for light or trivial reasons, defy constituted authority. In fact, quite the opposite. In the 1520s, when in the name of the Reformation, a lot of the so-called Peasants' War, and that meant peasants and other people in the lower ranks of society, rebelled against their government overlords. Some were ecclesiastical figures, some weren't. Luther denounced them and was very harsh. I thought that rebellion was probably the worst thing you could do. Tyranny was bad, but rebellion would lead to only worse consequences.
Did Luther, in time, come to understand his own importance?
I think so, yes. I do think so. He was conscious that God had used him in very momentous ways in the history of the church. And although Luther had no sense of what would happen after him, I mean, he thought he was in the last times and that the world was headed toward was in the tribulations of the last days. But nonetheless, I think he had a strong sense of vocation and that God had used him in a very special way to preach the gospel in these last days.
We remember him as the reformer. He's the quintessential reformer.
Mm-hmm.
From your understanding of Luther, did he think of himself as a reformer?
That's a good question. I think more one could say he thought of himself as a prophet and a teacher. And it was, in a way, up to others to implement reform. And this goes back to your first point. Those others often included the political authorities in Germany who had power to make changes. I mean, Luther had no institutional power to change one thing in any of the churches anywhere in Germany or in Europe. So he depended upon others, and through proclamation, through teaching, through preaching, moved those others to make the necessary changes to be the reformers. So I don't think Luther thought himself, at least if by reformer we mean somebody who was exercising institutional change, because that he didn't do.
By the time he comes to the end of his life, did Luther consider the efforts at the Reformation to be a success or a failure?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I would say some of both, because clearly he saw that in his own times the gospel was being proclaimed in a lot of different places in a way that hadn't been true at the time when he was a young man. On the other hand, he saw the forces of Satan really arrayed against those gospel preachers, persecutions, people being put to death, and then also the grave threat of war, where he saw the emperor perhaps acting as an agent of the Pope in order to destroy those who were now preaching and believing the gospel. So I'd say some of both, with maybe more of the latter than the former.
So a half glass, half full.
Yeah, maybe one-third full, two-thirds empty, something like that. Clearly, he knew that God had done some wonderful and good things, but he did not expect the church to enter into a period of prosperity. No, he thought that as time was running out, the devil would rage all the more, and that would lead the opponents of the gospel to act in the kind of the harshest way possible, and not only physically, but also within the church. I mean, the problem of Protestant disunity and betrayal of the cause, as Luther would have seen it by reformers in Switzerland and other places. I mean, that really confirmed Luther in his opinion that these were the last and worst of times.
Tell us the story of Luther, a brief biography, please.
Well, I think maybe the best way to think about Luther is, first of all, as a typical medieval Christian, somebody who took religion very seriously, but labored under the burden and obligations of the law, not only God's law, but also the laws and regulations of the church. And it was in connection with that kind of Christian ethos that, as a young man, he decided to become a monk instead of pursuing a secular career, because in the monastery, the Order of the Augustinian Hermits, Luther felt that he had his best chance of preparing for eternity. However, what happened through that choice was that he became ever more aware of his own personal inadequacies and inability to live up to the high standards of God's law, which demands perfection or holiness. And so increasingly he grew concerned about what was going to happen to him eternally. At the same time, his particular order directed him into a teaching career, and that teaching career led him to not only to learn about some of the great theologians of the medieval church, but also actually to study the Bible. And it was in connection with his biblical studies that he came to a new realization of what Christianity was: not rules, regulations, rituals, and ceremonies, but essentially the mercy and the love of God in Jesus Christ, our Savior. That changed his life. And then that also changed his sense of vocation. He was still a teacher of the church, but now he is a teacher with a particular message. And that message was one that many people responded to favorably, but others did not. And it's in this conflict between those who do and those who didn't that the Reformation was born. Let me just say then that Luther then kind of went from one incident to another in the course of his life in which he worked out the implications of his new appreciation for the gospel.
Did he come to that realization all at once? I mean, romantic picture is of this flash of insight drawn from Scripture striking him like a thunderbolt.
Right.
My picture in my mind was always one evening sitting in his little cell, it strikes him, and from that moment on, nothing is ever the same, and his entire mind changes in one fell swoop. Is that true?
Well, again, that's a kind of it's a question where there's a yes part of it, but also a no part of it. Clearly, Luther worked a long time as a student and teacher of the Bible, and only gradually came to kind of a fresh understanding of what Christianity was all about. I mean, one was the nature of God, as God is merciful and gracious in Christ. That was something that was opened up to him gradually through the study of the Psalms, for example. But there was, and Luther identifies it actually in his preface to the Latin edition of his works published in 1545. He does talk about what historians have termed the Tower Experience, which was an insight to the Romans 1:16 and 17. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for therein is the power of God unto salvation, for therein is revealed the righteousness of God. That phrase, righteousness of God, he really didn't understand until that incident within the tower, whereby he came to connect righteousness of God with what follows later in the verse, namely, the just or the righteous person shall live by faith. And then Luther says, and then I understood that the righteousness being referred to there was not the righteousness by which God demands, but the righteousness by which God saves and saves through faith. And that does seem to have been a climactic moment in his life. But that's not to say that it wasn't preceded by a lot of study and prayer and deliberation before finally he reached that insight, or if you prefer, God gave him that particular insight.
It is, we talked about one misconception about Luther a little earlier, that having come to this proper understanding of the centrality of Christ's righteousness in Christian theology, as he would call it, that alien righteousness or God's righteousness, that he very quickly said, okay, I'm done with all these crazy Roman Catholics, fooey on them, I now take my leave of them. We dealt with that one. What about another view of Luther, that it was only with the greatest reluctance, in fact, really against his will, that he broke with the Catholic Church's theology, and that if he would have had his druthers, he would have remained a Catholic, except for a few niggling problems that he had.
Well, I think it's true to say that he had no intention of starting a new church, and one that's named after him. I mean, that was the farthest thing from what he had in mind when he began to preach and to teach in this new way. But he did come to the conviction that his opponents within the institutional Catholic Church, as epitomized by the papacy, were not just wrong, but were agents of the devil and leading people to hell. And I think it's well known that Luther finally concluded that the Pope was the Antichrist on account of his opposition to the gospel. So when Luther was excommunicated from that church, he certainly didn't see that as a badge of shame or anything else, but indeed saw that as what happens when when you preach the gospel, Satan opposes with every weapon in his command. So I think, you know, there's some truth to the idea that this was not Luther's plan and intention, But I don't think one should think that all his life then Luther really wanted to be back in the Catholic Church. And I mean, that just isn't correct, because he saw this as the Church of Antichrist.
We're talking with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. Martin Luther's death was remembered yesterday by the Church. Dr. McKenzie is chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Our email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in number 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Calling from Southern Illinois, here's Herman on the line. Herman, thank you for waiting.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Dr. McKenzie, the program started on this topic with the assertion that in the mind of many people, Luther is seen as a social rebel, pressing the social envelope of propriety, so forth and so on. And I know today Pastor Wilkin has had people documenting, for example, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is pressing the envelope to institutionalize homosexuality in the church. Would Luther be in favor of this, and is this sort of those who want to have the homosexual bandwagon would cite Luther as living in his example of pressing in the envelope, liberating people? How would Luther look at this today?
Thank you, Herman.
Yeah, that is a very good question. Luther was strong on what we would call the gospel of freedom, but not freedom from morality or freedom from laws of right and wrong that God has put into the universe, but actually freedom from the burden and the penalties of such laws through forgiveness in Christ. In other words, Luther would say that there is a moral order in the universe that God established right from the beginning. You can find it in the scriptures, but you can also find it in the heart of every person, and certainly it's evident in every culture and tribe and nation around the globe. So that's a given, and that given includes things like marriage and the obligations of husband and wife to one another. Luther at times does refer to sodomy, and he describes it as a vice and a thing about which you shouldn't even talk. So Luther knew about this activity, and he condemned it as a part of the breaking of the moral order. But I think it's also important to realize that what drove Luther was not any kind of sort of social reform or change at all, but rather ministering to people who were burdened by the fact that they had sinned against God's moral order. And so what he would say to somebody who engages in homosexual activity or somebody heterosexual who commits fornication or adultery, he would say, look, this is wrong, and you know it in your heart, your conscience, and to those who repent, to those who felt burdened by such sins, Luther would offer the consolations of the gospel. He was a practical theologian, and for him, the basic remedy for sexual sin was marriage. This, he believed, that God had established in Genesis, male and female, and that this was the proper situation in which one should express his sexual nature.
One of the things that strikes me about Luther is he's obviously a genius. If you read especially his early works, theologically, philosophically, a towering intellect. He's hard to understand. He really is. And
yeah, sometimes. It depends on the work that you're reading.
And yet at the same time, such a down-to-earth, as you said, he is a pastoral theologian.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the engaging things about his writing style is that Luther cannot help himself from talking in a passionate way about issues that he knows are of eternal importance to the people who are listening to him or are reading him. Never is he kind of dry and academic. Even you know, and some of the parts which are confusing, you know, when he gets into the arguments about the real presence and kind of brings in some of the philosophical arguments and so forth. Nonetheless, it's always so important for Luther that we know the truth, because this is the way God wants to reach us with his message of law and gospel. So, yeah, I agree with you completely. And that's different from others who write at that time. If you read John Calvin, who's a clear writer, organized writer, and so forth, and says a lot of very good things as well as some things that aren't so good, you don't get that passion. You don't get that kind of engagement that you find always in Martin Luther.
You said as an important point when you're giving us that brief biography that he spent the latter part of his career really putting out fires, going from one thing to another. And it was, I believe, one of those fires he was trying to put out that brought him to Eisleben, where he eventually died. Tell us that story with about a minute and a half.
Yeah, sure. Well, Luther not only depended upon the local aristocracy to implement Reformation, but he was also concerned with government officials that they would live in Christian harmony with one another. And in particular, in the little province of Mansfeld, which Eisleben, I guess, was a part, the Counts of Mansfeld had a falling out with one another. It was long going. It had basically nothing to do with theology. It had everything to do with who was going to inherit, who was going to rule, and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, this falling out could threaten the harmony of the church and the people, the ability of people to kind of live together and follow the Reformation. So Luther went there to help the local nobility reconcile. They did, and Luther was successful in spite of the fact that he was old and sick. He went and was pleased that it helped. And then, before he could come home, he had his last illness, and he died right there in the place where he'd been born and baptized. He'd suffered from ill health for a long time. His cause of his death was probably heart failure. It occurred during the evening, I guess, of February 17th, February 18th, because he died early in the morning. Suffered a couple of heart attacks. His friends, Justice Jonas particularly, was with him and asked him if he was going to die in the name of Christ and the doctrine which he had preached, to which he answered a loud and affirmative yes, or I suppose jawohl in German. But at any rate, he died with still confessing Christ. And, well, I guess the other thing I'll mention is that they found a scrap of paper on which he had written some of his last words, and the very end of that scrap of paper said, "We are all beggars. That is true." And it's an interesting kind of last statement for him to have written.
And a fitting one. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. They have Christ Academy coming up this summer. It's June 17th through the 30th for high school aged men. It's a 2-week residential program where young men in high school can get a chance to get a flavor of what it's like to study for the pastoral ministry and plan for that in their future. For more information, 1-800-481-2155 is the number of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Todd Wilkin here, talking with Dr. Dean Wenthe, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Wenthe, tell us about Concordia Theological Seminary as a worldwide outreach.
We have, at latest count, about 23 different countries represented on our campus. We have a full-time staff member teaching in Lithuania, another in Siberia, and then our resident faculty teaches regularly in Kenya, in Haiti. We just recently received an invitation to teach in Madagascar. So our commitment is to be a light on the hill and to broadcast the light of Christ into all the world.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit them on the web at www.ctsfw.edu.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Are you tired of changing the TV channel during the family hour to find a decent show without blood and gore? If so, you're not alone. The FCC is taking the complaint to Washington. They've prepared a new report for Congress that says the government can limit violence on TV, especially during hours when kids are watching, without violating the Constitution. Josh Montez has more.
Take her inside, now!
No! Dad, stop them!
According to the Parents Television Council, Fox Network's hit program 24 ranks the highest of any primetime television show in depicting violent torture scenes. This in a time slot when most kids are tuning in. Dan Isett with the council hopes the FCC report spurs some action in Congress.
Essentially, it chronicles the problem of television violence. It affirms the causal relationship between exposure to violence in children and the acting out of those children.
The FCC offers two main recommendations: policies to control violent programming and a new pricing system for cable.
Among them, the Congress could constitutionally pass some sort of regulation on violent content on the public airwaves during certain times of day, much like they do with televised decency. And the other very critical recommendation is the idea of cable channels being made available individually.
It's called a la carte programming, where you pick and pay only for the channels you want in your home. Bob Peters with Morality and Media says cable choice is a no-brainer.
We should have a la carte, but a la carte standing alone, in my opinion, is not going to protect kids from media violence. It's part of the answer, but it's not the whole answer, in my opinion.
He says until the networks start policing themselves, it will be up to Congress to do something about violence on TV. For Family News in Focus, I'm Josh Montez.
According to the Washington Times, producers say they have to keep their shows edgier to compete with the violent fare on cable networks. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the Monday morning show, sign on at 7 a.m., wake up to inspiration, information, and delightful conversation between yours truly, Paul Clayton, and co-host Diane Summers, with our guests, Pastor Curtis Dieterding from Trinity Lutheran Church in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, biblical counselor and clinical psychologist Dr. Jack Fiennes, and Pastor Emeritus Walt Schadel, on the Monday morning show on AM 850 KFUO.
Concordia Publishing House and Issues Etc. are pleased to offer our Book of the Month for February, titled A Seminary in Crisis. It's a history book that you won't be able to put down. A Seminary in Crisis tells the story about the battle for the Bible in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the early 1970s. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The book, A Seminary in Crisis.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Arthur Brooks joins us for the next half hour of the program. We're going to talk about religion, philosophy, and charitable giving. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Brooks is a professor of public administration and director of the Nonprofit Studies Program at Syracuse University. He's author of the new book, Who Really Cares? And the subtitle there is interesting. It's The Surprising Truth About Compassionate Conservatism. Dr. Brooks, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what was the biggest surprise for you as you looked at charitable giving among Americans?
Well, the biggest surprise, actually, when I first started looking at this years ago, is the fact that Americans are so incredibly generous compared to people from other countries. There's just really no comparison. As a matter of fact, Americans are orders of magnitude higher in their giving and volunteering than people from many of our allies. We give 14 times more money per year than the average Italian family, for example. So that's the big surprise. And for a lot of people, that's stunning because we hear constantly that Americans are stingy, that Americans don't care about people around the world. But when you look at the data, that's simply false. That simply is not the case, particularly as we look at how we give of ourselves voluntarily. That's the first surprise. The overwhelming majority of Americans give. More than 75% of American families give money each year, and about half of American families volunteer their time. But another surprise that came was the fact that there was a big difference between the giving families and the non-giving families. And that's really what this book is about. What determines whether or not you're a giver or whether or not you're not a giver. And the stereotypes that we have about who's giving in America and who's not are frequently just frankly not true. They're just wrong.
Talk about the stereotypes for a moment. What do you think is the biggest myth regarding who gives and why?
Well, the biggest myth in a lot of parts of America today is that people who are uncongenial to government income redistribution are stingy people. And that's a myth because when you look at their private giving patterns, you find that they actually give substantially more away to charity privately than people who favor a lot of government income redistribution. That comes as a big shock to a lot of folks because there is this view that if you're not compassionate with government money, you're not going to be compassionate with any money. And the fact of the matter is that people who believe that the government should do less and that private individuals are responsible are in fact practicing what they preach. You find that people who disagree that the government should redistribute more income give four times more money away than people who agree with that statement. And that came as a big surprise to me because I'd been hearing my whole life that if you disagree with certain kinds of politicians who want to raise taxes and provide more services, that means you're an uncompassionate person. And I sort of took it on face value, which I shouldn't have because I'm supposed to be a scholar in these things, but I did anyway. And I found that the opposite was true.
Okay, then as you looked at this, I guess the big question is why? Why on that one issue, those who do not take a favorable view toward redistribution of wealth by the government, what is the philosophical presupposition that makes them, on the other hand, quite generous and charitable?
It really comes down to culture, in my view. I mean, as an economist, I've been doing research for many years on things like how tax rates affect people's charitable giving. But the fact of the matter is that tax incentives and economic incentives in general are not the story. The story about charitable giving in America and any other place is about culture and it's about values. People are moved to give because of their values. People learn to give because of their parents and because of their churches and because of their communities. They learn that these giving values are critically important and it enriches their lives. So the reason that people who are skeptical about the government typically give so much is because they're in a culture where giving is so important, where incidentally the culture indicates that the government is not the solution to all ills. Now, I understand that people disagree on these issues. I mean, reasonable people disagree on these issues. The interesting thing is how they behave so differently depending on their view of the world. And incidentally, part of the culture, and probably the biggest single determinant of charitable giving in America today, is the cultural element in this part of America, which is faith. You find that people who consistently practice their religious faith, be it Judaism or Christianity or Islam, give at vastly higher rates and vastly more money as a percentage of their income and even in real dollars as people who are secularists in America today.
We were talking with John Green from the Pew Research Group. I know you know I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about, I think a couple weeks ago we were talking with him about the effect of religious voters on the 2006 and then the 2008 elections. And one of the things that he pointed out, I can't remember what term he used, but for the lack of a better term, how deeply one is involved in their religion, attendance at church and devotion and things like that. For him, he saw a correlation between that and voting rates, how likely they are to simply vote in a given election. Do you think there's some coincidence here? Is it simply a matter of higher levels of involvement, engagement in society, the needs of society, whether it be voting or needs for charity?
Sure. In fact, and you go back to the idea of the intensity of religious observation, people who are more intensively involved in their congregations are less checked out. They're more involved in general in things around their lives. They take a broader and more active and deeper role in the cultivation of their own faith. And so it's no coincidence that they're going to take a deeper and cultivating role in all sorts of other parts of their lives as well. Their citizenship, their children's schools, their role in society, their jobs, and everything else. You're going to see all of these things basically moving together. One of the things that you find is that one of the best predictors of all kinds of nutritious attitudes and behaviors in society is how people and how sincerely they take their spiritual lives. Now, this is not just an argument that Christians are the only people who can become good citizens. I think that's self-evidently false. But you do find that people who do take their interior life, their philosophical life, their spiritual life seriously are simply better equipped to take on society's challenges and to perform as the best citizens that they can possibly be.
Is there a correlation between income and giving? And if it is, what is it?
Yeah, that's a pretty surprising answer, actually, to that one. It is true that people who are richer give more money away. You'd be shocked if that weren't true. But what you do find that's really quite surprising is that poorer people in America today, the working poor specifically, are the ones that give away the biggest percentage of their incomes. And it's actually a substantially larger proportion than the rich, and especially bigger than the middle class. In terms of the biggest sacrifice, you have the working poor, followed by the wealthy in this country, and in last place, the middle class. In point of fact, all of us as Americans can take a charity lesson from America's people of modest means, as long as they work for a living. Working for a living is quite critically important.
Did you go into the why of the working poor being, as a percentage of income, the most charitable?
Yeah, there are a couple of different reasons for that. One is that the working poor, frankly, are extremely religious in the United States, and they belong disproportionately to religious congregations that have tithing requirements that are not inconsequential. They're quite serious about it. Now, one of the things that I do find in my research, incidentally, is while I could show that to a lot of secularists who'd be cynical about it and say, see, these congregations are preying on people of modest means to give so much money away, the fact of the matter is the more that people give, the more that they get. And that's not a religious observation. That's an empirical observation from an economist, that I find that the more people give away, the better off they do financially and socially. So this is a great favor to people, that they belong to organizations that expect their observation and expect their participation. So one thing is religion, for sure. Another thing has to do with the fact that the working poor in America are pretty income mobile, and part of an income mobile mindset is one in which you don't feel like a victim, but rather is part of the solution to problems. And the way that you act that out is by giving to other people. And so it's no surprise. Once again, this gets back to culture. The culture of success and the culture of mobility involves serving other people. That's just one of the things that we always find among people who are becoming more and more successful.
Do you have any information on the mechanism there by which you talked about the correlation between people who give and those who do better socially and economically? What's the mechanism there, or did you discover it?
Sure. Psychologists have been really interested in this for a long time, and in fact, it's one of the most exciting emerging areas of research on charity that we have these days. What psychologists typically tell us is that people, in fact, feel more in control of their lives when they give. One of the best pieces of self-improvement advice that any psychologist will give you is to serve other people. Because what it does is it makes you makes you a problem-solving machine. It makes you better equipped to actually take care of problems in your own life. People who feel less like victims are spending more time looking for solutions, and giving is a real kind of therapy for people. They become more successful, and the fruits of success are both monetary and non-monetary, for sure. But they also find that people who give a lot have a lot of meaning in their lives. Giving is a tremendous source of meaning for most people. And when they give for the first time, they never stop. John Templeton, who founded the Templeton Foundation, said that he had seen many people fall away from their faith, but never, never had he seen a man who'd fallen away from his tithing. The fact of the matter is, once you start giving, you're never going to stop. And the reason is because it just feels too good, and it's just too good for you.
Where's the money going? I know it's not all money, but where are the charitable dollars going?
They go, charitable giving, which is a tremendous amount, it's about $260 billion a year, which, you know, at $250 billion is more than the entire GDP of Sweden or Norway or Denmark. That's how much money we give away in this country. It goes in about three equal parts. The first part goes to sacramental religious activity. It goes to churches, to run churches, for example. The second third slice goes to religious non-sacramental activity. It goes to non-profit religious organizations that are providing services, so Christian colleges and Catholic hospitals and things like that. That's where the second third is going. The third piece, goes to totally secular types of organizations that are involved in obviously in non-religious services. Those are the three parts.
Is this a boon to the overall economy? These large amounts of money going to charitable organizations?
Well, yeah, it's a big boon to the economy for a couple of reasons. One is that nonprofit organizations provide critically important services, and these services will not and cannot be provided adequately by government, at least the government as we see it in the United States these days. We need these services. We need public services in terms of education and health and arts and culture and social services and everything else. Without these things, we would be less efficient, and we would have a less satisfying life. The second reason has to do with the fact that this provides all of us in society a satisfying opportunity to discharge our need to give. The fact of the matter is we need to give. And without nonprofit organizations that we can fund, we don't have proper things to give to. This is a great service that nonprofit organizations, churches, charities, and other causes provide. One of the greatest services that they provide is connecting communities of need. People with a need for services, connecting them to those of us, which is to say all of us, that have a need to give. And in so doing, they make us better in terms of stronger communities, economic growth, personal prosperity, and better public health, even up into and including more effective citizenship. You find that people, when they give, more likely to vote, more likely to contact public officials, and it gets back to the story that you were telling me earlier about the fact that religious observation is connecting to these fundamental core four square citizenship values.
We're talking with Dr. Arthur Brooks. He's a professor of public administration and director of the Nonprofit Studies Program at Syracuse University, author of the new book, Who Really Cares? America's Charity Divide, Who Gives, Who Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Our call-in number as we come to you live this Monday, the 19th of February, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. The way that the conclusions of your book largely were paraded in the press were, well, Brooks discovered that social and politically and moral conservatives give more, and social, political, and moral liberals give less. Is it that simple?
No. The fact of the matter is it's not that simple at all, because politics has relatively little to do with it. Politics coincides with a lot of the giving values that we have, the culture of giving that we have in the United States. But the fact of the matter is that religion, for example, is far more important. Attitudes about the government fundamentally are far more important. So, for example, if you will find that conservatives give more than liberals in the United States, give more money away, even though they earn slightly less, they give about 30% more dollars away. But it's not because they're more generous or more virtuous fundamentally. It's just that they're higher numbers, for example, that tend to be religious. You find that there are about three times as many religious conservatives as there are religious liberals. Now, religious liberals and religious conservatives are equally generous, is what we find. But there's so few religious liberals comparatively that religion is making conservatives look pretty good, as a matter of fact. Now, the least generous group in American society today are secular conservatives. Interestingly, there simply aren't that many of them, so they don't bring the numbers down, but that's a real challenge to conservatives, is to understand how we can deal with that, because that's a substantial challenge to the conservative movement.
So a secular conservative, just for the sake of definition, would be someone who is generally non-religious, but socially, morally, and politically conservative in their on the issues.
Yeah, well, these are generally speaking people who say they're conservative or very conservative, and they either have no religion or they never practice a religion. Now, typically, these people are younger, which means they're less likely to give. They're men, which means they're slightly less likely to give. And they have a few other demographic characteristics that pushes them away from a lot of charitable giving. But it also means that simply the conservatives, most of whom are religious and are giving a lot, simply are not connecting with philosophical conservatives that don't happen to be religious, and by giving them all kinds of opportunities to give.
Does marriage status or family status, number of children, seem to bear upon this at all?
It does. You find that married people are most likely to give. It's not marriage per se, but rather the fact that married people tend to be happier is one of the reasons, and happier people are more likely to give. When people have more kids, it's absolutely the case that they give more. This is interesting. A couple that has no children is less likely to give than a couple who has one child. Having two children, your likelihood of giving goes up by 5 percentage points. 3 to 6 children, it goes up by 5 percentage points more. Beyond 6 kids, and you know, who knows, because people with that many kids don't answer surveys, apparently, because their homes are chaos. The more kids I have, the least likely I am to answer surveys, that's for sure. But you absolutely find that kids make people more giving. Now, that's paradoxical, incidentally, because kids drain your wallet, yet they make you give more money. And, you know, religious people understand this because people who are deeply religious typically will talk about the fact that their religious experience is modeled in the experience of having children, that having children is fundamentally about giving, and it helps them to be better givers just as they have a giving relationship with their Heavenly Father. We hear this a lot from people of faith. So, for example, so that's not a big surprise. But just from a social science perspective, what you're going to find in looking at the data is that family relationships, coupling and raising children, is very good for charity.
I have to ask you, because I'm sure you were thinking about this when it happened June last year, Warren Buffett, who's a Nebraska multi-billionaire, decided in advance of his death that he wasn't going to leave it all to the kids, but he was going to give at least a reported 85% of his vast fortune, we're talking about maybe $50 billion when all is said and done, to a charitable organization. It came out as the largest charitable donation given in U.S. history. What did you think when Buffett decided that he was going to give it away rather than pass it on down as wealth for the next generation of Buffetts?
Well, it was a wonderful thing. Warren Buffett's a hero for doing that, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he's a hero twice over. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, as much as I might disagree with them philosophically on many issues, or even disagree with the way that they give their money or what they give their money to, they have created tremendous economic growth and economic prosperity for our country, and just through their entrepreneurship and their capitalism have been great heroes, in my view. But they're doubly heroic because they've thought about creating all this wealth so they can give all this wealth away. I mean, this is the American ideal, is working hard in entrepreneurial capacity, individual opportunity and mobility, and then philanthropy. I mean, there's no other country that does capitalism and philanthropy so well as the United States. So they're prototypical in this way. Now, I might be a little disappointed if I were Warren Buffett's kids, I have to say. And incidentally, the part that he gave back to his kids, he gave to their foundations for them to give away. So it's really all about the philanthropy. The interesting thing about Warren Buffett is that he knows he's much better at making it than giving it away. So he's given his to Bill Gates. Bill Gates, the second richest man in the world, is giving his fortune to the richest man in the world, and they're pooling it in this mega foundation, the largest foundation in the history of the world, which is the Gates Foundation, which is doing a tremendous amount of good in the world.
Is this on the upswing, Dr. Brooks, or is there any kind of trend going up or down when it comes to charitable giving as far as we can track it among Americans?
It's going up, and it's looking good. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the rich are getting very rich in the United States, and there's no indication that they're going to become less philanthropic. Over the next 50 years or so, we can expect at least $40 trillion to be transferred in wealth. That's practically four times our annual entire GDP that's going to be transferred from one generation to the next. And that means that a lot of Gen Xers and young baby boomers are going to have tremendous wealth, and a lot of people are going to be leaving a lot of money to foundations. The rate that foundations are being created because of new fortunes is going up faster than it ever has in history. And more young people are getting interested in philanthropy for the first time. So I'm very encouraged by that fact. Now, some people will interpret these very same data that I'm telling you as evidence that we've got too much income inequality, and what we need to do is raise taxes and equal it out and just take it away from these people so they don't have the money to start foundations in the first place. Now, I disagree with that, because I honestly believe that the engine of entrepreneurship has to rely on the ability for people to make fortunes in the first place. But I just hope and am very pleased to see that so many people that are creating all this economic growth are also willing to give it away to important causes.
One of the things that I found interesting in reading your book is that, and this came up several times, there's a perception on the part of the individual American about how charitable they think they are. Or,
right,
as you say, how charitable they feel, that is out of line with a lot of Americans with how charitable they actually are.
Right.
How do you explain this, I feel charitable, when in fact someone isn't?
Well, there's this view among a lot of Americans that there's equivalency between giving through the government and giving of your own private resources. Now, it might be a smart thing to do, to give through the government, but it's not the same thing as giving private resources. This belief that it is the same thing, however, leads people to believe that if they think the government should raise taxes and spend more money on social services, that that is evidence of compassion, just this belief itself. There's a tendency in Western countries to make this substitution. We've seen it all over Europe. It's effectively, with secularism, has decimated Western European charity. Western European charity in many places simply doesn't exist because there's this view that we do all of our charity through the government. We've discharged our charitable obligations and our charitable needs through what we do with taxes. If you talk to any middle-class Norwegian, that's the argument that you get. Now, is it wrong? Well, it depends on your point of view. I think it's actually wrong because it's not equivalent. I think that they're not the same thing. It might be smart to give money through your taxes, but it's not the same thing as giving charitably. So when people believe in that equivalency, they have a tendency to discharge their obligations vis-a-vis their political views. Very, very dangerous phenomenon, in my view.
Finally then, Dr. Brooks, with only a minute, what about, and it goes back to the question I asked about the trend for the future, is charitable giving something that one can say is passed down, not the money, but the behavior, the habit of giving in families?
Absolutely. People learn to give, and they learn to give in all sorts of different places. There's the in order, the best three ways to teach charitable giving are A, family, B, church, C, school. School is a distant third. What you find is that the best way for you to teach your kids charity, if you think it's an important value, is for them to see you giving. And people who come from charitable families just give overwhelmingly more than people who don't come from charitable families, and they talk about the experiences they've had of their parents giving. Now, when it's doubly potent is when charitable families are families of faith. Because then you have charitable givers who are giving to their churches and giving to causes outside of their churches, and they're seeing the need and they're seeing the ask every single week. These people are virtually assured of growing up to become givers. If there's one thing, the person who grows up in a giving family that goes to church is just simply going to give. That's just simply the way it is, and they've learned to do it.
Dr. Arthur Brooks is professor of public administration and director of the nonprofit studies program at Syracuse University, author of the new book, Who Really Cares? America's Charity Divide, Who Gives, Who Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
Look, it's seeing the need. This is with someone's eyes open to the need. The need has never been as great as it is today, and it will continue. Think about all of the need that's out there, not only in this country, but around the world. And when you think about that tonight, think about LCMS World Relief, a relief agency that is concerned with both body and soul. Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief have their eyes out for the need, and part of what they do is make you aware of that great need for your relief dollars. Call them 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438, or find Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time reviewing Beth Moore's teaching. She's right in the middle of a series on forgiveness. We'll find out whether or not it has anything to do with the cross in the third hour of Issues, Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We give thanks for the folks at LCMS World Relief because they are the hands and the feet that allow many people to reach out in charity and love to those who are less fortunate than we.
Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Arthur Just on the importance of LCMS World Relief.
In the Gospels, Jesus says that he came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And spending out his life for us on the cross is how he served us. Because Christ is in us, and we embody him in his mercy and love, we are to manifest that in our lives. And LCMS World Relief does exactly that, by reaching out with concrete expressions of Christ's love, mercy, and compassion to those who have been broken by storm and tempest, who for whatever reason, need the kind of love and compassion that is in us because Christ is in us.
For more information or to donate to LCMS World Relief, call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438.